Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Right.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning, I'm Dave Kubikin.
And Dave and I are hosting the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour this morning. And we're here each Saturday morning from 8 to 9 o'clock to chat with you, answer your questions, take your phone calls, and hopefully get some information to you on the areas of estate planning, estate administration, asset protection planning, wills, trusts, beneficiary designations, and all kinds of stuff going on this year. And so, welcome. If you would like to be our first caller, you can reach Dave and I at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Morning, Dave. How are you?
Morning. I am doing well. Yourself?
I am excellent. I am excellent. Are you having a quiet, socially distanced, non-shouting Super Bowl party at your house tomorrow?
Well, I can't guarantee anything on the shouting front, but it will not be a lot of people. It will be just two or three family members, and that's it.
Yeah, us too. I did hear Ben earlier this morning on one of the earlier newscasts announce that the CDC or someone had announced that you should not shout at your TV tomorrow afternoon or tomorrow evening, that it was could be a health hazard to others if you yell and scream too loud at the play that's going on. So, or if you do, Ben, are you there?
I'm right here.
I heard that earlier around, I don't know, 7:30 or
yes.
So you were on.
It's absolutely true. Yes, you should not shout. That's more for people that don't live in your household. Like if you go to a Super Bowl party, you should not be shouting at your TV. So, yep.
Well,
that's true.
I think Ben, maybe it should be you should not go to a Super Bowl party.
That's true, too.
I think you inserted that if in there. And you know, it's starting to get a little lighter at night. You know, lighter, longer, rather. I'm starting to notice. And I heard a couple birds the other day, and I feel like if we all just put our head down and get through 3 months, 2 months here, I think we'll be better off for it in May. So, you know.
We will be. We'll be getting outside again. We'll be able to get outside in the fresh air where there are fewer viruses floating around and all that stuff. Did you?
People getting vaccines and more, hopefully, and so hopefully we're in a better place in 3 months or so.
I am. We had finally, my wife, you know, saw it, you know, up and down and right and left for a week on the internet. I mean, there were just no appointments around here. So I think we have appointments, not next week, but the week after. But we have to go to Utica to get our shots. So I don't know. It's the closest we could get.
Well,
so next closest, I think, was Plattsburgh or Potsdam. Jeez, that's a death. I don't really...
Harry, David.
Yes.
We have our first caller this morning. We have Patty in Rotterdam.
Morning, Patty. How are you?
Morning, Patty.
Good morning. How are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yep. You're fine. You're on the air.
Okay. I was just wondering about the difference between a family estate planning and a Medicaid estate planning. And I realize that there's a lot of detail to it. But my husband and I would like to do the estate planning, of course. We initially thought we would do the Medicaid estate. And then someone recommended to us that we do a family estate because we only have one older daughter and, you know, not many assets to put except for the house to put into the estate. And I was just, I'm sort of in a quandary because I just don't know what route to take. I know there's a lot of detail to it, but if you could just shed some light on that and briefly explain the difference.
Sure. So, Patty and Harry, let me just jump in real quick here. So the best thing I could tell you right now, and this is very self-serving, is you need to go check out one of our webinars. There, you could just go to our website and click on one and listen to it. You know, they range from like 40 minutes to an hour and 10 minutes or so. And it'll provide such a good baseline for you to understand some of these different areas that you're talking about, because, you know, when I hear you say family estate or Medicaid estate plan or family estate plan, it's kind of all the same thing. We're not talking about different things. Those aren't different things.
Oh.
And, you know, there's little tweaks in documents, perhaps. One kind of trust versus a different kind of trust, which means that down the road it can help you qualify for Medicaid if you have long-term care needs. But it's not even called a Medicaid trust in our office. It's just a trust. The rules of the trust will dictate what kind of plan you're setting up. And it may serve you really well to you know, go through one of those webinars just to kind of get your ducks in a row before meeting with someone like Harry or myself or Debbie or Jay Marie, because I love that you have people in your life who are giving you their two cents on it. But based on how things are being termed here, I don't know if they understand all of it either. And the best thing you can do is get as much information as possible. And we happen to have these webinars on demand as well as free consults to talk mm-hmm. more about it. Because it's not just a radio answer, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you should have. I mean, just to kind of answer your question, you know, you and your husband should really, the basic components of an estate plan are going to be essentially, to begin with, a will, you know, a last will and testament for each of you. You, both of you, need really important documents, a power of attorney for each other, and a healthcare proxy. That's kind of the basic component of everyone's estate plan, because if you don't have any documents, if you don't have a will and you die, said you're married and you have an adult child, you know, if you have assets that are in your name alone, and your house is probably in joint names, but if you die without a will and you have a surviving spouse and a child, you know, for most people would think that everything passes to your husband that's just in your name. That isn't true. Under the law in New York, your husband gets the first, I think, $50,000 and half the rest, and the other half goes to your child. So that may not be what most people want. They want to have everything available for the surviving spouse and then down the road pass assets on to the children. You know, to add on an asset protection trust down the road is something you could always do, you know, depending on your age, your health, and things like that down the road. So some people just start out with a basic estate plan, and then down the road they could add on the what you call the Medicaid asset protection plan, which would insulate things like your house and some of your savings from exposure to, you know, very, very high long-term care costs down the road. So,
yeah,
you know, but... So you can start with the one and add the other. I mean, like if you're only in your 40s or something, as opposed to your 70s, maybe initially that kind of a basic estate plan would work for you for the next 10 years or so. And then you could look at the other in the interim. You can always add on, you know, you can always, it's like building an addition onto your house. You know, we may have to move a wall here, you know, to open it up so we can add on the family room. But we can cobble your estate plan together over the course of years, because as David was saying, estate planning is it's kind of an ongoing process. It isn't like you just do it once and then it's fixed for the rest of your life. You kind of have to go back every 5 years or so and revisit it. And you know, it may need a little renovation, restoration, or some additions to it, depending on what happens in your life with yourself and your own family members, both health-wise in terms of assets. Assets go up, assets go down. Family members, you know, have children, they get married, they get divorced, they die. And all those different events that we all experience in life can have a significant effect on your estate plan.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate all that input. Thank you. And, you know,
sure.
We're both 65, and we want to mm-hmm. really, I guess I misspoke, but I really, you know, I got a little flustered, but I really,
okay.
We really were really interested in the Medicaid trust. You know, but I understand what you're trying to tell me, and it's really helpful.
Well, the thing you really, both of you ought to do is, you know, you could always come in for a one-hour conference with David or me. We're available, and, you know, we'll sit down and have an initial meeting with you and explore this stuff in terms of your own particular situation. And we don't, you're not going to have a bill for that initial consultation. You know, it's free. So, you know, if we're going to do some work for you, yeah, we're going to charge you a fee, and you're going to know up front before you decide to do it what the fee is and what we're going to do. But you can come in and you know, pick our brains for an hour and get your questions answered. And, you know, it's a free appointment. So it's really something that both of you ought to take advantage of. 65 is kind of a milestone for a lot of people because you're either retiring or you're thinking of retiring. You're signing up for Medicare, and you say, oh, my God, the last time we did our will, you know, our child was like 12 years old, and now they're 35, you know, they're 20 or 30. And that's the last time we looked at it. It's been sitting in the drawer for 20 years, you know. So you're your situation is very typical of most 65-year-old people that come into our office. So, you know, we're here when you're ready, and we'll try to help you. So, okay, cool.
All right. Do I have time for another quick question?
Yeah,
sure.
Go ahead. I think
not?
So. Sure. Yes, you do.
Okay. Just let me know. We also considered putting our daughter on the deed of the house, adding her on, as I know some of my other friends have done. But you know, my concern is that if she gets sued, and then you know. That could be it with our asset from the home. Do you recommend people doing that? I mean, she's a very responsible young woman, but what is your opinion on that, or is that too
well,
long
I'll
of
tell
a,
you, that a lot of people do it. It is not my recommended way of doing things two particular concerns: creditors and predators. All right. If you deeded your house to your daughter and you and your husband retained what's called a life estate or a life use, it means you continue to live in the house, you pay the taxes, you pay the insurance, utilities, nothing changes. However, now your daughter's on the deed, okay? If she has a downturn in her life, if she develops an illness, if she loses her job, if she had to file for bankruptcy, if she was in a bad marriage and was getting in an unpleasant divorce, if, God forbid, something happened to her, you know, she predeceased you, you got her on the deed, and her creditors could put a lien on your house. The other issue is, when you sell, there's a tax reason, too, that it's not a good idea. If you sell a house that you've lived in for two of the last 5 years before you sell it, you don't have to pay the government any capital gains taxes. You know, if you bought your house 30 years ago for $150,000, and now it's worth $250,000, the $100,000 of appreciation, if it wasn't your house, you'd have to pay long-term capital gains tax on. When you sell your house, you don't pay that tax unless it's more than $500,000 if you're married and $250,000 if you're not married. Now, the problem is if your daughter's on the deed, unless she lives with you, you're going to lose a big chunk of that capital gain exclusion, and somebody's going to have to pay some tax on that sale if you decide to sell the house and move into a smaller place or an apartment or a senior living facility down the road when you're 75 or 85. So if you put the house in a trust, okay, instead of putting it right in your daughter's name, she's going to wind up owning the house anyway down the road. You still can sell it and move into a senior housing or an apartment or something else, or you could move to Florida if you choose to. But in the meantime, it's inside the trust. Your daughter could be the trustee. And if something happens to her, the fact that she's a trustee, her creditors can't put a lien on your house because she doesn't own it. She's just like a custodian. So those are kind of things we'll talk about you know, when you come in. So.
Right. Great.
A lot of these questions that people like, you know, I know what you do. You lay awake, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you think about this stuff and say, oh my God, I know I got to do something, but I don't know exactly what I should do. And so.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, we're here. Whenever you just call one of our secretaries or call the, and, you know, come on in and chat.
Yeah, you're right. And I all of the above, and this information was so helpful. I can't thank you enough. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Take care. Enjoy the Super Bowl tomorrow.
Bye.
Okay, 476-5900 is our number here in the studio. We're not actually in the studio, but but this is the number in the studio. You will reach the studio if you call out. David and I are here to answer your questions. So, you know what? Next week, this is it's tax filing season. So next week, Friday, February 12th, is the first day the IRS is going to start processing income tax returns for last year for 2020. So, I don't know. Have you started yours yet, David? I have not started mine.
I have not started anything whatsoever. we're day-to-day in the Kabikian household. We have two little kids.
Right.
There's remote learning or in-school learning. There's a toddler, so... Day to day, Harry Miller.
Learning in quotes. Remote learning in quotes. Yeah.
I did want to talk about something, Harry, and this is something you and I have talked about quite a bit on the radio. So a now client of ours, we're retained to do help with the nursing home Medicaid application and move some money around, save a boatload of money. That's not what I want to talk about for the moment. So. In our normal intake, right, our normal consultation with someone, as you were just talking to Patty about, we ask you for some information. We ask you, do you have an existing estate plan? Do you have a power of attorney, you know, et cetera? What does the family tree look like? Yada, yada, yada. And mm-hmm. and the client, she said, we have a power of attorney. And I said, well, when did you get it done? Because based on when it was done, we know what it's going to look like. And, sometimes, you know, how thick is it? Because we'll know, are the right provisions in there? Just
is it 2 pages long or 12 pages long?
Exactly. So she said, I have it with me, and she took out the power of attorney, put it on the table. I looked at it, and instantly I knew because it was a little too thin. It was recent, and it didn't have enough pages, meaning it didn't have everyone, that's called a statutory gifts rider, something that actually won't be needed in the future, but right now, a power of attorney.
Till midsummer, we got to, it's going to change, but not till July, I think. Yeah.
So here's the deal. Her husband has a traumatic brain injury, and it didn't come on all of a sudden. It was gradual, but it's a pretty big deal. And while things were going on and he, you know, he was kind of going downhill, they went to an attorney, Harry, and that attorney did the power of attorney for them. That attorney did not specialize in what we do. Okay, that attorney wasn't an elder law attorney or a trust and estates attorney. It was a guy who says, I could do a will for you. I could do a power of attorney for you if you need, right? Not a problem. And the problem is, Harry, that the provisions in this power of attorney that allow wife to buy things and pay bills and sign for husband doesn't allow her to gift.
Shouldn't have any transfer powers. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And husband has assets that are above what Medicaid will allow. And unlike the circumstances you discussed with Patty, husband's bank account is just in his name.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a wife who, theoretically, the things we're doing, I'm sure you're already thinking, is move money to wife, and then she's allowed to have more than the applicant. And if she has way too much, there's always other options like spousal refusals and gifts and loan plans and this and that. Guess what, everyone? I can't do any of that right now because the power of attorney doesn't allow her to do it. And we have a creative solution to it. That hopefully will work. I don't know if it will, but if it doesn't work, Harry, that was tens of thousands of dollars lost because an attorney that doesn't specialize in this area did it. And this is why I don't do real estate closings, and this is why I don't do your personal injury lawsuit, because that's not what we're good at. And I'd love your thoughts on, we have talked before, but if you could reiterate to everyone why it's so important in this area, particularly to use, and this isn't like a Herzog ad, this is a use an estate planning attorney when you're doing estate planning ad.
Harry, David,
everybody,
can I,
yeah.
Harry, David, can
right
I jump
ahead.
In for just a second? We do have a caller. We have.
Well, put the,
yeah, go ahead. Finish. Go ahead and finish. We have Larry in Albany on the line. So when you're done, just let us know. We'll put him on.
Yeah. No, I think. I'll tell you what, let's take the call, and then we'll go back and talk about the importance of the statutory gifting rider. It's going to take more a minute or two. So put Larry on. We'll talk to you. We'll come back and talk about the transfer rider and the power of attorney form, okay?
And Larry is here.
Larry?
Hi. I have two questions, actually. One is a statement that we have trusts and things that you set up for us. And we also have joint accounts and everything else. But we have a piece of property, a vacation property in the state of Vermont, which we own jointly with my brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, if we pass, that piece of property, I know that piece of property, unless we do something with it, will go into probate. Does that mean the entire state goes into probate or only that piece of property?
So Larry, real quick, you said you know that it would go through probate, so that means that the way the deed is titled to that property, it is not with rights of survivorship, correct? It just has your brother's name and your name on it?
Yes.
Okay. So that means... Gotcha. So that means that you guys have 50%, they have 50%. And yes, you're right, that 50% needs to go somewhere, and absent language in the deed that says where it's going to go, or some other way to avoid probate, like it being in a trust, transferring your one-half undivided interest into your trust, which you can do, it goes through probate. And it'll be to the extent of the value of that interest, because that's the only asset that's in probate. It's a property in Vermont, and you're a resident of New York. So we need to take a couple steps in New York before someone can take a couple steps in Vermont. And so, you know, if you didn't have a trust already, I'd say one of the things to add to the you know, put on the ledger in the trust column would be, well, now you have property in two different states. Absolutely try to avoid probate, because it's double the fun, and you know, to be sarcastic.
Yeah, double. It's also double the legal fees.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem. You can put
your one half in the trust.
You can put your Vermont real estate in your New York trust, you know.
Okay, so you can do that for us.
Yeah, I have a house in New York, and I have a house in North Carolina. They are both in my New York trust for the same reason David's been talking about. I don't want to have to probate my will twice when I die to sell those properties.
All right, I guess we'll make an appointment, because...
Sounds like a plan.
Larry, it's just a simple deed. I mean, it doesn't get more complicated. We don't have to change the terms of your trust. However, let me ask you.
Yes.
What happens if you know, you and your wife are no longer here? Do you want that half to go to your brother? Are your kids going to use that property? Do you want it to be, you know, what's the future of that property? Now it's in a trust. It avoids probate. But, you know, someone still owns the house. Is that the result you want?
No. We want our half to go to the kids.
Oh,
your kids, yeah, sure.
That's what
yeah.
I mean. So that's fine. So the trust will
have a buy-sell arrangement, which means that if my brother or his family want to sell it, that we have the right of first refusal and likewise.
That's a good way to handle that. It really is. Family, it's like a summer house or a summer place or, it's a... Those can be complicated, but it's a good thing there's only two owners, because, you know, as time goes by, sometimes the ownership gets fragmented among three or four or six kids, and then it can become a little cumbersome to manage. But, you know, I think you have it set up. It sounds like you have it set up the way you want it. Yeah. But we ought to get it out of. You don't want to have to probate your will in Vermont for that asset. So, you know, it's a simple fix. If you call us, we can get that done for you.
Larry, hold on just a sec. The other thing that you may want to consider, I have an article on this that I'm happy to email you offline. So this is basically like a vacation home, and it's all great when it's all great. Things are very easy when everyone gets along, when it's just two families we're talking about, right? It may be in several decades, a generation from now, it might be four or five families that are sharing an interest in this property. And even though it's a wonderful property, property is not meant to be owned by four or five different families just like that. So one of the things you may, you and your brother may want to talk about before you come in is, does it make sense to put that Vermont property into an LLC where you guys each have half the shares? Because then you could put rules on the shares. You could have an operating agreement that says what happens to this property in the future. Who does get to go there 4th of July weekend in the year 2040? Because now we have so many more people who want to be there. You know, are one of your kids going to be equally responsible for the expenses, even though they live in North Carolina next to Harry and they're never up there? So those are some of the long-term things that you guys want to think about. Short-term, obviously, avoiding probate is wonderful. You could also avoid probate and come up with that plan by utilizing an LLC where you guys put some rules on it. This happens, it's so common, you know, in the Catskills and Great Sacandaga Lake, Lake George, right, Vermont homes, even people who own property down south. So something to consider.
You said you have something to send, but you could email me on that?
Yeah, I'll send you an article on it. You could put all sorts of rules on it and so on and so forth. Things get messy even when there's a trust. If there's a property that, you know, everyone loves and shares, if there's no rules on that property, it can get a little messy.
It's lakefront property.
Well, there you go. Thanks for the call, Larry.
Thank you.
And we have another caller. We have Jennifer from Albany on the line.
Morning, Jennifer.
Hi. Is this Harry?
It is.
Yes. I just wanted to ask a question. I have a son that is married, and his wife doesn't work. She's a teacher, but she doesn't work right now. And she doesn't. They have a 16-year-old daughter. And my problem, I wondered if my son has on the mortgage. Now, if they run into money problems, which I think they are, they bought a home 3 years ago for $460,000, and she doesn't work. And is he responsible only for that mortgage, or does she also own it?
Wait, who's the who? The house is in whose name? It's not in joint names?
No, it's not. It's in his name.
It's in his name. I don't know. It depends. If the house is just in his name, he certainly is liable on the note in the mortgage to the bank. It could be sometimes if the title is only in one name that they would. Were they married at the time they bought the house?
Yes, they were.
Okay. I mean, she may or may not have signed the promissory note, evidencing the debt. And without looking at the mortgage papers, I can't give you a distinct answer to that. But normally, the bank would just have the person who owns the house sign the mortgage papers, including the note. The note is what obligates the borrower to repay the loan from the bank. The mortgage just secures the note and says, if you don't pay the note, we can foreclose the mortgage, you know, and sell the house. So it depends how highly leveraged it is, whether he has any, you know, if they default on the house and the house was sold for less than they owe the bank, they would owe the bank the difference. It's called a deficiency judgment, all right? And they could take that out of his other assets. She may or may be liable on that, and, you know, I mean, if it's a $460,000 house and they only borrowed $300,000, chances are there won't be a deficiency judgment anyway. But if they borrowed 95 or 98% of the purchase price, then there could be a problem. So hard to say, but I'd have to see the papers. But she isn't automatically liable unless she signed the promissory note to the bank.
My problem is that she is capable of working. There's no reason why she can't, but she doesn't. If it's a concern for a divorce, he would be the one that ends up paying for that house.
I don't do matrimonial law. That's more of a divorce matrimonial issue than an estate planning issue, but you know.
Okay.
If I could just add, it's definitely not a radio issue. And I think I have some of the answers for you, and I think Harry could as well, but it might be a little more beneficial to talk in the office at length.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I think we're at the bottom of the hour now. We're gonna take a little break, and then we'll be right back.
We are. We're going to take the break right now. We'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for,
options available for Medicaid planning, and more.
With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany,
West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs,
Executive Woods in Clifton Park,
and Flatbush Road in Kingston,
our attorneys are here to help you.
If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David,
Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie,
please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581.
Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131.
Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010.
And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405.
Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back to the second half of the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour, brought to you by the Herzog Law Firm. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Dave Kubikian.
David and I are two of the attorneys. We're with the Herzog Law Firm. We have conveniently located offices in Albany, New York, Clifton Park, Saratoga Springs, and Kingston, New York. And we're here each Saturday morning to chat with you for the 8 to 9 radio hour. Questions about estate planning, asset protection planning, Medicaid access, home care, we do a lot of home care, advanced directives, estate administration, you know, taxes, IRAs, beneficiary designations. We've been talking about questions about deeds, putting your kids on deeds today. We've been talking about a whole variety of issues. If you own property in more than one state, our caller in the first half hour was, you know, tipping him off about avoiding an expensive probate proceeding out of state for the summer home. So we'd love to talk to you here for the next half hour. And our number in the studio is 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Where were we, Dave?
Before we get to where we were, let me let everyone know what our webinar calendar looks like for the next week and a half or so.
Webinar Wednesdays, right?
We have Webinar Wednesdays. Next one, obviously, is coming Wednesday. That's February 10th. And on Wednesdays, we do a 10 a.m. and a 2 p.m., Harry. 10 a.m., the webinar is What to Do When a Loved One Dies. So that's going to focus a lot more on the estate administration, maybe trust termination aspect of estate planning. And at 2 p.m., it's more of a Q&A where we have a number of frequently asked questions that we're going to tackle. But unlike the other webinars, you know, everyone can unmute themselves and fire away with all their questions. Harry, it's kind of like the end of our client appreciation seminars where we're just, you don't know what kind of question you're going to field, and it's quite fun to go through. And then next week, the week after, so the week of the 15th, that's our webinar week, where every single day we have a 2 p.m. webinar. You can go to our website, herzoglaw.com.
Even on Valentine's Day?
Schedule.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, Valentine's Day is a Sunday this year.
Oh,
so,
it is. Okay,
yeah.
Then.
So cool. You got to get your flowers.
So
on
now, Friday. If I want to sign up for one of these webinars, what do I do? How do I do that? Do I do it on my phone,
computer? How does Harry Miller do that? Well, you walk out of your door in your office, and you go to the next door, and you say, "Hey, Dave, I'd like to go to your webinar."
Hey, Dave. How do our listeners?
I see. Right, so you can go to our website, herzoglaw.com, and all the webinars are there, and you could click on the ones that you want to attend. You can call our office, 518-465-7581. You can email us at info@herzoglaw.com as well. And one in particular I just want to focus on, Wednesday the 17th. I don't know if Larry is listening anymore, but Larry, at 2 p.m., the webinar we're doing, it's a lot of the same stuff, but we are going to talk about what it means when you have assets in two different states and why it becomes even more important to have a good estate plan. And Harry, that's a good segue for me to get you back to where we were before some of those great
David,
calls, which is
David, oh boy, Harry. Ben. We're not going to get back to that just yet because we have Carol on the line from Schenectady.
Hey, Carol.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I'm single with no children, and I have a will, a very detailed will, and I have a durable power of attorney. Mm-hmm. I have nieces and nephews, but they really don't need anything from me. They're very, very well off. Is it necessary for me to have a trust?
To have what? A trust?
Right.
Yeah, well, so let me, Harry, if you don't mind, I just want to, because this is such an interesting question, and so many of our clients deal with it. I've actually put a lot of thought into it. And this may sound like crass, but I think it's the right way to look at it. So the trust is not for you. And what I mean is that when people do a trust, most of the time it's not for them. It's for their kids. It's for their beneficiaries. It's for the charities they're leaving money to, because you will not be here to see what it's like to go through probate, right? You're no longer here. That's the reason for the probate. You're not going to be here to see all the money that you saved the beneficiaries of your estate because you did that trust. And so if I said to you, by not doing that trust, there's a potential that you're going to, you know, your estate will be worth far less, and whoever you are leaving things to will get less money. If that's a fact that doesn't, you know, keep you up at night, so to speak, then, you know, you may not be as motivated as someone else to do the trust that accomplishes those things. And
exactly. And none of my family needs my money. And I have a very explicit will with everything in it. And I have two co-executors. One is an attorney and one is a CPA. So, and they're family. Mm-hmm. They're family.
It could be that your plan is perfect as it is. It could be that, you know, that power of attorney should be updated because during your life we shouldn't do a guardianship and there's certain powers that aren't included in it. I don't know. I'd have to look at it. It could be you need to tweak who gets what in terms of your assets. If I can give you just a quick example of what I'm talking about, where I saw it in my own family. So, I think Harry knows it. One of my grandfathers had dementia, went through everything that we do, except it was in California. So we kind of saw the nightmare scenario. My grandfather developed signs. We planned ahead of time. We did what we had to protect assets. He passed away before we ever got there. Fast forward, sorry for the family history. Another relative where my mom is in charge of things for them. She keeps saying, you got to do this, you got to do this. And they said, well, I don't want to do it. And she said, well, then, you know, your nieces and nephews are going to get less money. And the relative said, I'm okay with that. That's fine with me. That's not a problem. And I said to my mom, well, there's your answer, right? For that relative, their motivation. So I hope, Harry, that people don't think we're always just pushing trust, because the fact is we are pro-estate plan. And your estate plan can take all sorts of forms.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, no, I agree. You know, I agree.
One of my brother did say to me, he said, don't leave anything to my daughter because she's a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't need my money. It's just going to raise her taxes, and she's going to have to pay taxes on my 401k and a lot of my other assets.
So let me go the other way for a moment, because this is the counter argument is, well, I prefer for the, you know, quote unquote, air quotes, government not to get my money. And if I spend a little bit of money to make it so that doesn't happen, or so I do leave it to friends, or I do leave it to what a great charity I want to leave my money to, it'd be wonderful if there's more money to leave them. That's the counterweight to what I just said. But it's whatever your plan is. And it comes back to that question, how upset would you be if a lot of your assets, you know, were quote unquote, used up or wasted, right? So it's specific for each person.
Right. And if it's for my health, then that's the way I have to use it.
For sure, and you would it's your money. If you have health care needs down the road, you're going to use the money to take care of yourself. You're gonna pay to have home health aides. If you have enough money, you're gonna have home health care aides come into your house and take care of you before you go to a nursing home or assisted living facility. It's just because that makes the most sense. I would only add that whether or not you need a trust, I don't think you necessarily need a Medicaid asset protection trust. Whether or not you need another type, like a revocable trust, just to avoid probate, not to protect assets from a nursing home, the only thing I would anticipate, if you anticipate that there's going to be a fight over your estate among your nieces and nephews, if you have nieces and nephews, for instance, and you're leaving your entire estate to charity, that might be a problem down the road that you could minimize by putting it in a trust. If you think everybody's okay with it, then as David said, there's no reason to... We have a philosophy in our law firm, if it ain't broke, don't fix it,
I feel very comfortable. They're all going to get something, but they're not going to get everything. I mean, I volunteer for a wonderful charity, and they've been very, since my retirement, they've given me plenty to do, so they're going to get a chunk of it.
All right, and that's appropriate, and that's what you want. And it sounds like your family is on board, and they have at least a general idea of what your estate's testamentary scheme is. And so, I think you sound comfortable with it. Probably works.
With the durable power of attorney,
every power of attorney today is durable by default. Durable. The word durable in power of attorney simply means that if you become mentally incapacitated, the power of attorney is still valid, okay? The agent you've appointed can still act on your behalf. That's what durable means. Years ago, when I first started practicing law, shortly after the Lincoln administration, but years ago, in the 1970s, when I was practicing law, powers of attorney were not durable. In other words, if you made a power of attorney appointing somebody your agent, if you lost your marbles, if you became in the advanced stages of dementia, the power of attorney was no longer any good. And now you had to go hire another law firm to appoint a guardian or a conservator for you to manage your assets under a court-supervised conservatorship. So at some point in the early 1980s, somebody woke up and said, hey, wait a minute. If this person was mentally competent when they appointed the agent, why the heck can't they continue to act if they lose their mental faculties? And say, oh, okay. Well, it was a lot of this stuff in the law is driven by the fact that 80% of the state legislature are lawyers, and they make busy work for other lawyers to earn fees, which are largely unnecessary in some instances. So now, unless you say, in the statutory form now, it automatically says this power of attorney will still be in effect if I'm no longer mentally capable of acting on my behalf. Unless you say otherwise, which nobody ever does.
No. So. Like she said, if I'm traveling, like if I go to Europe, she said, if something happens to your home, if your home burns down, she said, I have the power to fix it up and get it taken care of without you worrying about it.
That's right. She can get in touch with your homeowner's insurance company. They can come out, do the valuation. They can handle the reconstruction, all that stuff.
In the meantime, I have shown my two co-executors where all my papers are.
That's very important. It's very important that people know where your stuff is. What you're in, and particularly not only your physical stuff, but if you have an online presence, if you have a digital life through bank account, through passwords, through the internet, it's critically important that people know how to find those key passwords, because your digital life lives on long after you're gone. And also, if you, I mean, we have a digital statute in New York, but every company has different rules about accessing this information. You know, E-Trade is different than, you know, whatever the other, you know, Alley Bank, or, you know, there's all these different online banks and brokerage firms. And God, people, I did last week, I have a client who has cryptocurrency, you know, like Bitcoin.
Wow,
and stuff.
Yeah.
But that stuff is, I mean, apart from being a very highly volatile investment, boy, getting at those things is you know, it's very different. And people that have those kinds of assets need to pay particular attention to how they transfer them when they die.
Do these companies allow a durable power of attorney to transact all these things?
Well, the New York statute does. The New York statute says that a person who's either an executor or a trustee or a power of attorney or a guardian has the legal authority in New York to access the assets in the Bitcoin account. Now, the problem we run into a lot is, you know, with a Bitcoin company, could be incorporated in Delaware or in California or in a foreign country, for instance. And they may not necessarily recognize or follow the laws of New York with respect to New York domiciliary. So it can be a problem because as we get more global, we're less regional, we're less local, we're less state, and even less, you know, country. But so you got to kind of get your estate plan in order so somebody has the ability to access those assets on your behalf. Yeah.
Right.
Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Take care.
And we have another caller. We have Barbara in Ballston Spa.
Good morning. I have irrevocable, I'm sorry, trust with you. In that, when it was set up, I have two co-trustees to distribute after I pass. But my real will is filed in Albany. I have a copy. They have copies. How do they, when I pass, how do they go about getting the real will?
Well, Barbara, you know, since you have a trust, I'm hoping that if you title the things outside the trust appropriately, there actually won't be a real need for that will, because the assets that typically would pass through probate will pass based on the terms of your trust. That's one of the pros for doing a trust. Now, if you have,
I've done a trust with you.
Right. So I understand. What happens is that when we do a trust, we'll also typically do a will, and you know, people have wills prior to having trust as well, obviously. And having the will doesn't really mean anything. Your will doesn't pass assets unless when you pass away, you own assets that are governed by your will. So, for example, you have a trust. Let's say you put your house in the trust. The will no longer governs what happens to that house because the house is owned by the trust. So the terms of the trust will dictate where that will go. It means we don't need to use that will at all for it. And we can.
But why is it filed in Albany?
Well, we didn't file it. You must have a will that a previous lawyer did for you. And some lawyers file the will with the surrogates.
I've done that with you. And
we wouldn't have filed the will.
Oh, yeah, maybe what you mean is that we have it in our office. So we have a vault where we keep the wills. We don't, as Harry said, we don't.
Yeah, and that's what I was told by the person that did my will with you. And that's what I want to know. How do they obtain that?
Oh, I see. So
they just call our office.
Yeah.
They just call our office. And the original will. Yeah, our Albany office at 7 Southwest Boulevard. Yeah, I mean, you could come in on Monday and get the will if you wanted to. It belongs to you. We just have it here for safekeeping because it's not usually a good idea to put your will in a safe deposit box, because then we got to get a special thing to open the box to get the will out.
I understand, but my question is, how do my co-trustees, which are indicated in my revocable trust, how do they obtain this will, which is filed in Albany?
they call our office and they say, I am so-and-so, I am the executor of your estate, and I need to pick up the original will. And then we will ask them simply to send us a copy of your death certificate so that we know you're dead. And,
oh, okay.
And then they'll come in, we'll give them the original will, and they'll sign a receipt that says we transferred the original will to them. Unless we're going to handle the estate, in which case we would keep the will if we had to probate the estate so we could file it with the surrogates court.
Okay. So okay. That's why you have
that's
it
why.
And keep it, the real
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm just curious, in the paper today, the Times Union, they have a word. I'm talking about vaccination now.
Yep.
I have been on and made all the indication of my age of ancient times, and I could not get through to get a vaccination in any way. And the
nobody
word
can.
Is comorbidities. What is that?
Comorbidity. All right. What the governor said yesterday is that shortly, I don't know if next week, they are going to include people who have comorbidities as eligible people to get the vaccination shot. So that means they're going to issue a list of those things. So probably people with high blood pressure, for instance, people who have COPD, all right, we used to call it emphysema. People with other respiratory diseases, could be people who are diabetic. Comorbidity, so if you got the coronavirus because of the other condition you have, you are at a higher risk of winding up on a ventilator or possibly dying from the coronavirus. Those people, in addition to anyone over 65, if you're over 65, you're already eligible to get a coronavirus shot.
I know, I'm eligible.
The problem is you can't get an appointment anywhere around here, okay?
Right.
The earliest, I think my wife looked yesterday, I think there are appointments available at SUNY or somewhere around in the end of April, all right? Okay, so it's February, March, it's another, 10 weeks away. My wife and I finally got appointments about 3 or 4 weeks ago. We have to go to Utica to get our shot.
I can't do that. I'm not able.
And most people can't. We're able to drive. We can get out. But you can't get there. You don't have anybody to drive you there. And it's a mess. There's no easy way to get signed up for these vaccination shots. And I don't know, we're all in the same boat in that sense. So,
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess I keep putting in and getting a nice message from the governor.
Well, here's the problem, ma'am. They keep adding more people to the list of people who can get the shots. And it's like the governor said about a week or two ago. He said, there are 7 million people in New York State who are eligible to receive vaccines. And next week we're getting 250,000 doses. Which we have to allocate among 7 million people. Right now, there's not enough supply to meet the demand. Eventually, that will catch up, but it's going to be probably spring or early summer before we get to that point. So the rest of us just have to stay safe, stay socially distanced, not to shout at our TV sets tomorrow during the Super Bowl,
Okay, well, thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening, ma'am. We appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Okay, you too.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Harry, I'm afraid to say anything because I'm figuring Ben is just going to jump in here and say we have another caller.
I'm not going to jump in. No,
okay.
I'm not. No, but I do have a question.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Because a young lady called in. She didn't want to go on the air, and this is how she started the phone call.
Uh-huh.
This is a really simple question, and I said, hang on. None of the questions are simple questions. I said, I'm going to ask this question, and they're going to need to answer it and ask you questions. So I'm going to ask the question, and if it's simple, then you'll give an answer and we'll see what happens. This lady has an irrevocable trust, and she owns multiple properties. If she goes in the nursing home, is she able to sell her property before she dies?
Yes.
Yeah. It should be yes.
Okay. Then that was a simple answer.
Right. When you put the property in a trust, Well, let me say this. It was, yes, you can if it's one of our Medicaid asset protection trusts.
See, I knew.
That is,
I knew.
That is.
Well,
you know, for every rule of law, there are 12 or 14 exceptions. You know.
Yes.
So there are certain types of trusts that exist that she could put her property into where she couldn't sell it. But if it's a plain old vanilla Medicaid asset protection trust, and we did it, and you put it in the, believe me, you will be able to sell the property. And that is mainly because our trust, unlike some other law firms' trusts, retain certain very important powers to the person setting up the trust. One is the power to remove the trustee and appoint someone else. And the second is the power to reallocate who gets what's left of your money after you're dead. So those powers allow you to indirectly have some influence and control over decision-making inside your trust. It also retains to you the right to live in the house and control the use, ownership, disposition, and sale of the house down the road. So, yeah, our trusts, the answer is yes. There are other law firms' trusts I have seen where the answer might be no. You can't sell it if the trustee decides not to do that. In ours, we can make that happen.
You're effectively substituting cash, money, for the real estate. So, you know, people think they put real estate in the trust area. Really, they're putting value in the trust.
That's right.
The value of the real estate. And so if that value, you know, if the pile of money looks like a house one day, that pile of money can, you know, turn into a pile of money that looks like cash, which is essentially selling. We also allow you to replace trust assets with other assets of equal value, which also is the same idea, right? We're replacing cash. We're putting cash in instead of having a house in. So absolutely. And in fact,
well, it's a great, go ahead.
It wouldn't be worth it, right? The trust wouldn't be worth it if you couldn't do those things. The idea of the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust is not just to protect things from Medicaid, to help you qualify. It's to avoid probate, but to do it all while you still get the same use and enjoyment of your assets.
Got it. Sounds like we're out of time, David. Hey, everybody, have a great weekend, and we will talk to you next Saturday. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.